Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record Program number 739, Turkish Taffy, Part 3. This program is being recorded on April 10th of the year 2011. This broadcast is, I promise, I swear, going to be the last one for the foreseeable future on the piggyback coups, probably not on the WikiLeaks phenomenon, because that's just going to keep leaking all over the floor, so to speak. But there has been a lot going on. The piggyback coup, as I call it, the October surprise meeting the Bay of Pigs, is not only very important, it is one of the strangest things I've seen in a long time, and also, frankly, very challenging from the standpoint of a researcher. One supportive listener, I would note, had characterized my analysis as, quote, messy or sloppy. Messy was what he put it. And again, this is a supportive listener. And indeed, I think that that is an absolutely appropriate comment. And this is a very messy reality. And so to the extent that it has been messy or bumpy, well, I apologize, but I think that, frankly, it was rooted. It is rooted. The messiness is rooted in the messiness and the subterfuge and just the outright chaos and confusion that is inherent in these events. In the front page, at the top of the description for the Record Program number 737, there is a good bullet point summary of some of the major features of the discussion on the piggyback coup. And I think it is outside of the scope of what I'm going to be able to do in this broadcast, if I'm going to make this the last program in some time on this subject, to sum that up. But as I mentioned in past programs, and it's even more important now, and will continue to gain in importance, please use the SpitfireList.com website. And at the top of the description for the Record 737, there is a good bullet point analysis. Also, I want to make an emphatic correction. I misspoke myself. I knew what I meant, but I didn't say what I meant to say. And that is Tariq Ramadan of the Muslim Brotherhood. He is not the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, the founder of the Brotherhood. He is the grandson-in-law of Hassan al-Banna. Saeed Ramadan, the father of Tariq Ramadan, is the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna. Tariq Ramadan, whose op-ed column was carried in the New York Times in February of 2011, he is the son of Saeed Ramadan, the son-in-law of Hassan al-Banna, therefore the grandson-in-law of Hassan al-Banna. So please note that for the record, so to speak. Now, I'm going to very quickly recap a couple of stories that I had to fit very quickly in the conclusion of the program for the Record 738, and that is the extension of the piggyback coup or coups to Libya. I want to stress that among the dynamics that are unfolding in various Middle Eastern countries are tribal power politics, so to speak, and I am, to say the least, anything but an expert on tribal power politics in the Arab world. So I certainly would not want to attempt to say, well, this is how this is going to work out, or this is how this is going to play out, because I don't know past a point. It is impossible for me to imagine that it's going to work out well. For one thing, blood is flowing and bullets and bombs are flying in the Middle East, and that does not work out well. Generally speaking, when there is bloodshed and when there is chaos and warfare, it benefits the forces of darkness. I mean, that'll seem a little silly or facile to some people, but generally when people start killing one another, somebody wants to get back at somebody who killed somebody close to them. And in general, it's difficult, even though we are, that is to say the United States, is deploying combat arms on behalf of the victims in this situation, it is difficult for me to imagine that long-term this isn't going to play into the dynamic of the U.S. waging war on and or killing Muslims and Arabs, even though we are fighting on the side of, quote, light, unquote. I don't think the U.S. has really thought through what it's doing here. And indeed, it appears to me that vis-a-vis the piggyback coup or coups, the Obama administration is not on top of things. And I think October surprise and the Bay of Pigs, both covert operations that helped to destabilize, on the one hand, Jimmy Carter's presidency and to an extent JFK's presidency as well, both were operations undertaken under the realm of their predecessors. So I don't know how things are going to end up in Libya, but it's difficult to imagine they're going to end up well. And one of the things that's so interesting is that people from the tribes that we are helping against Gaddafi have apparently been deeply involved in jihadist activity on behalf of al-Qaeda and other Muslim Brotherhood offshoot organizations against the United States. The following is from Rolling Stone magazine of March 21st of 2011. It is an article titled, U.S. Bombs Libya Helps Jihadists, and it reads as follows. America is now at war to protect a Libyan province that's been an epicenter of anti-American jihad. In recent years, at mosques throughout eastern Libya, radical imams have been urging worshippers to support jihad in Iraq and elsewhere, according to WikiLeaked cables. More troubling, the city of Derna, east of Benghazi, was a wellspring, unquote, of suicide bombers that targeted U.S. troops in Iraq. By imposing a no-fly zone over eastern Libya, the U.S. and its coalition partners have effectively embraced the breakaway Republic of Cyrenaica. And by the way, many of these pronunciations may be incorrect. Please bear with me. That last one is C-Y-R-E-N-A-I-C-A. I'm going to pronounce it Cyrenaica. As you can see on the map above, Libya is a mashup of three historically distinct provinces. As recently as the 1940s, Cyrenaica was an independent emirate with its capital in Benghazi. The enmity between Cyrenaica and Tripolitania runs deep. The emir of Cyrenaica awkwardly cobbled together modern Libya and ruled as its monarch. This is the same king that Gaddafi deposed in his coup of 1969. And the Gaddafi regime has seen the former king's homeland as a threat ever since, as this WikiLeaked cable from our Tripoli embassy explains. Eastern Libya had suffered from a lack of investment and government resources, part of a campaign by the al-Qaddafi regime to keep the area poor and theoretically less likely to develop as a viable alternative locus of power to Tripoli. Another cable reports that the disrespect is mutual, again quoting from what we're told are leaked State Department cables, again vis-a-vis WikiLeaks very quickly. One of the strangest phenomena I've ever seen, and what sort of, you know, where are these cables coming from? And who is vetting their authenticity? Very strange situation, and not a good one. Everybody, it seems that most of the so-called progressive sector are lining up behind WikiLeaks. There's every indication that this is a destabilization of the Obama administration and the United States, basically a Nazi data mining and propaganda outfit, as well as a destabilization of America. And it ain't good at all. More time permitting about WikiLeaks later on in the broadcast. Another leaked cable, if we can trust what they say. Residents of eastern Libya view the al-Qaddafi clan as uneducated, uncouth interlopers from an inconsequential part of the country who have stolen the right to rule in Libya. That's the background. Flash forward to 2008. A West Point analysis of a cache of al-Qaeda reports discovered that nearly 20% of foreign fighters in Iraq were Libyans and that on a per capita basis, Libya nearly doubled Saudi Arabia as the source of foreign fighters, as the top source of foreign fighters. The word fighter here is misleading. For the most part, Libyans don't go to Iraq to fight. They went to blow themselves up along with American GIs. Among those whose work, unquote, was detailed in the al-Qaeda records, 85% of the Libyans were listed as suicide bombers. Overwhelmingly, these militants came from cities in northeast Libya, an area long known for jihadi-linked militancy, unquote. A WikiLeaked cable from 2008 explained that Cyrenaicans were waging jihad against U.S. troops as, quote, a last act of defiance against the Gaddafi regime, unquote. After the U.S. normalized relations with Gaddafi in 2006, Cyrenaicans believed they no longer had any shot at toppling him. Again, quoting from this, quote, leaked, unquote, cable. Many Easterners feared the U.S. would not allow Gaddafi's regime to fall and therefore viewed direct confrontation with the government of Libya in the near term as a fool's errand. Fighting against U.S. and coalition forces in Iraq represented a way for frustrated young radicals to strike a blow against both Gaddafi and his perceived American backers. The epicenter of Libyan jihadism is the city of Derna, the hometown of more than half of Libya's foreign fighters, according to the West Point analysis. That city of 80,000 has a history of violent resistance to occupying powers, including Americans, who captured the city in the First Barbary War. A surprisingly readable cable titled, quote, Die Hard in Derna, unquote, makes clear that the city, again quoting, takes great pride, unquote, in having sent so many of its sons to kill American soldiers in Iraq, quoting one resident as saying, quote, It's jihad, it's our duty. And you're talking about people who don't have much else to be proud of, unquote. Again, remains to be seen where things go. More backup for the viewpoint that is maintained in that story. This from the Telegraph in Britain. From the Telegraph of March 25th of 2011, article by Duncan Gardam and Praveen Swamy. This is titled, Libyan Rebel Commander Admits His Fighters Have Al-Qaeda Links. It's the fighter in question is Abdel Hakim al-Hasidi. It reads in part, In an interview with the Italian newspaper Il Sole 24 Ore, Mr. al-Hasidi admitted that he had recruited, quote, around 25, unquote, men from the Derna area in eastern Libya to fight against coalition troops in Iraq. Some of them, he said, are, quote, today on the front lines in Ajabaya. Mr. al-Hasidi insisted his fighters, quote, are patriots and good Muslims, not terrorists, unquote, but added that the, quote, members of al-Qaeda are also good Muslims and are fighting against the invader, unquote. His revelations came even as Idriss Deby Itno, Chad's president, said al-Qaeda had managed to pillage military arsenals in the Libyan rebel zone and acquired arms, including surface-to-air missiles, which were then smuggled into their sanctuaries, unquote. Mr. al-Hasidi admitted he had earlier fought against the foreign invasion, unquote, in Afghanistan before being captured in 2002 in Peshawar in Pakistan. He was later handed over to the U.S. and then held in Libya before being released in 2008. Well, as one of the things that I've noted in connection with the rolling coups, and this is not in any way to be, what I'm about to say should not in any way be interpreted as an endorsement for totalitarianism, autocracy, dictatorship, or any other form of repression. I would hope at this point that my instincts on behalf of democratic rule with a small d would be pretty well established and credible. So I don't want to be misinterpreted as holding a brief for the various autocrats that we've supported in the Middle East. But the fact of the matter is that many of them had been ostensibly at least allies, unquote, against al-Qaeda and other active military offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. And Yemen was one of those. I'm not going to go into that in this broadcast due to the limitations of time. Libya under Gaddafi, for one old enough to remember the Libyan hit squads, unquote, of the early 80s. This is quite a switch. But if the Obama administration's failure to support Mubarak, Mr. Saleh in Yemen and others, if this results in terrorist incidents against American troops or American personnel, or, God forbid, against targets here in the United States, particularly really bad terrorist incidents like WMDs, something along those lines, you're going to see a right-wing backlash of an order that a magnitude that you cannot imagine. And again, I think that one of the targets, one of the goals of the piggyback coups is nothing less than the destabilization of the Obama administration. In that context, do note that the price of oil is going up, and that's going to affect the economy and destabilize things, not only in the United States, but also in the very Middle Eastern countries where these uprisings have been taking place, because everything, when the price of oil goes up, the price of everything goes up, including food, and when people are impoverished, and many of the peoples in these countries are, that's going to make things that much tougher. And as we indicated last week, the work that the would-be reformers have in these countries is daunting enough. Very interesting point was called to my attention this past week. We have spoken in the past about Wael Goneem. He was the Google marketing executive and a graduate of American University in Cairo itself, an epicenter of Muslim Brotherhood connected to economic development theory. Wael Goneem was one of the galvanizing figures in the Egyptian uprising, what I call the piggyback coup. On his Wikipedia page, there's an interesting detail. As I've indicated in the past, Wikipedia has to be used very carefully. Check the links. If they don't check out, be careful. I really am not in a position to comment past a point on the following, but on Wael Goneem's Wikipedia page, on his in his Wikipedia article, there is the following. 1998 to 2002, helped in the launch of one of the most visited websites in the Arab world. And what that is called is www.islamway.com. Islamway is one word, the words Islam and way combined. When I went to visit the website, it's in Arabic, so I couldn't really say what is on there. It's difficult to imagine that this is not a Muslim religious website with a name like Islam Way. It is to be hoped that it is truly, quote, moderate, unquote. Don't know. Don't read Arabic, and the website's in Arabic. But one wonders, and the question that this raises for yours truly is Wael Goneem an Islamist? Somebody pointed out that his rhetoric, where he talked about being martyred and expecting to be martyred and putting his all of his property into his wife's name, sounded very much like Islamist slash Muslim Brotherhood rhetoric, but it remains to be seen if, in point of fact, that was the case. And again, if this is opaque to many listeners, if this sounds strange or confusing, as one supportive listener said, this is a very messy reality. It's an extremely messy reality, and I'm doing the best I can in this series to make sense of it and to lay out what I think are the main dynamics. After I'm finished with this program and starting with, for the record, 740, we're going to be there. So many other things going on in the world, the economy, things are getting very interesting in Europe. So I'm going to be moving on to other subjects, obviously updating this as conditions warrant. But suffice it to say, I think the economy, the Obama administration, and probably the lives of an awful lot of people, including members of the listening audience, are in the balance with regard to this. And I think that at balance, this is going to prove to be a very dark situation indeed. And I think ultimately, if the uprisings do not, in fact, engender social enlightenment and progress in these countries, I think we're likely to see Islamic fascism and warfare and bloodshed on a scale we have not seen in a long time, perhaps not ever. A couple of interesting stories, once again, highlighting my misgivings. A number of articles that we read in For the Record 738 saw a recent referendum as a hands-on victory for the Islamists in Egypt. We're going to talk more about that. One article, and I'm going to include this in the description for the program, I'm not going to include it in this broadcast due to the limitation of time, but a recent poll by a UN-connected think tank actually found that the most popular group, according to those polled, was a secular party in Egypt called the Wafed. I may be mispronouncing that, W-A-F-D. It remains to be seen what takes place, because there are a number of Islamist parties. The second most popular was the Muslim Brotherhood. There is also the Al-Wasat party and the Salafists. If Egypt pursues, as seems almost certain, a parliamentary form of democracy, not the winner-take-all that we have, a coalition among Islamist parties, including the Al-Wasat and Muslim Brotherhood and Salafists, seems like a very probable coalition partner. Now, more about the, quote, moderates, unquote, that we're told are dominating the scene in Egypt. Actually, many of the people espousing moderation are those who have been active bloodletters in the past. We spoke last week about people connected to the assassination of Anwar Sadat engaging in the political process. Now, more about veterans of that and the Gamal al-Islamiyah organization. This is the group that assassinated Sadat. It's connected to the blind sheikh who was connected to, who in turn was deeply involved in the first plot against the World Trade Center. And this is the group that massacred 60-plus tourists at the Luxor Temple in the 90s. The LA Times story that I'm about to read, predictably, as is the case with so much of the rest of the American mainstream media, not to mention the so-called progressive sector, but they will not talk about the fact that the Gamal al-Islamiyah, or I may be mispronouncing that, is an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. That's the, quote, moderate, unquote, Muslim Brotherhood. Article, Islamists in Egypt seek change through politics. We've seen a lot of these types of stories. LA Times story, April 3, 2011, by Jeffrey Fleischman. Naguib Ibrahim once spoke of slaying infidels and creating an Islamic state that would stretch from the Nile Delta to the vast deserts of Egypt south. Today, he lives in a high-rise with a view of the Mediterranean Sea and has the soothing voice of a man who could lead a 12-step program on rejecting radicalism. Ibrahim's group, Gamal al-Islamiyah, plotted notorious attacks, including the 1981 assassination of President Anwar Sadat and the massacre at an ancient Luxor temple that killed 62 people, mostly tourists, in 1997. He spent 24 years in jail reading the Quran and tempering the rage of his youth. Quote, "We were young and we took extreme measures, but now we're old men and our time in prison has made us wiser," he said. Al-Qaeda and Islamic militancy have lost their glamour. Look at what has happened. The young saw that violence didn't bring change to Egypt, and a peaceful revolution did, unquote. Ibrahim is one of an increasing number of ultra-conservative and moderate Islamists seeking a political voice in a new Egypt. Since the downfall in February of President Hosni Mubarak, who for three decades kept religion far from the center of power, the Islamist message is unshackled. The Muslim Brotherhood, the largest opposition party, expects a strong showing in September's parliamentary elections. The secular reformers and 20-something urbanites at the vanguard of the January 25th revolution have found themselves eclipsed. They lack experience and grassroots networks to compete with the Brotherhood and other religious groups that have quietly stoked their passions for this moment. In a sense, Mubarak's obsession with both co-opting and crushing Islamists instilled in them the discipline and the organization that now propels their political agendas. Egypt has long been the touchstone of the Arab world. The protests in Cairo's Tahrir Square that ended with Mubarak retiring to his villa on the Red Sea riveted the Middle East. That drama suggests that Egypt's post-revolutionary era, its emerging blend of politics and Islam, will have tremendous influence on what evolves in coming generations across the region. The political Islam popular in Egypt strikes more the tone of the moderate Muslim party running Turkey than the fundamentalist theocracies presiding over Saudi Arabia and Iran. Last week, by the way, folks, we took a look at some of the political foundations of that, the Rafah Party, Mr. Erbakan, associate of Ahmed Huber, who in turn views people of the likes of Omar Amin, von Leers, Heinrich Himmler, Adolf Hitler, Jean-Marie Le Pen, the Grand Mufti, and other extremely immoderate individuals as political role models. And again, when one, although ostensibly, we're told, the AK party has distanced itself from its parent organization, the Rafah Party, again, in light of all of the profession of moderation that we're seeing. That's why I call this last part of the series Turkish taffy. Turkish taffy, of course, is a candy. It's a sweetened confection, and I think that's what we're being handed vis-a-vis the, quote, moderation, unquote, of the Turkish Islamists. At the core of the, quote, freedom flotilla, unquote, a Muslim Brotherhood covert operation into which the Israelis, a trap basically into which they fell in most clumsy and inglorious fashion. But basically, the fact of the matter is that operation was put together by the Turkish government. And time permitting, in the second half of the program, we're going to be taking a look at some of the dynamics that may be unfolding in a competition between Egypt and Turkey for the sentiments of the Arab and Muslim world. As I said last week, I suspect that when the grinding poverty and the overwhelming social problems that beset that region prove insoluble to the would-be reformers, I suspect, you know, let them eat Israel, so to speak, or let them eat Jews scapegoating will hold the day, and that's likely to prove altogether lethal, perhaps lethal in a thermonuclear sense, ultimately. So again, take the professions of Turkish moderation here with a grain of salt. Take the Turkish taffy, that sweetened confection, with a grain of salt. Continuing with the story, political parties based solely on religion are still illegal in Egypt, but the military council ruling the country has astounded many by permitting Islam a wider role. Analysts suggest this tolerance is calculated so that in coming months the army can hand over the nation to an elected parliament after assurances from the Brotherhood that it will not run a candidate for president. Egypt is not the only nation where Islamic messages are whispering alongside the clamor of revolt. In Yemen, religious radicals are seeking to exploit anti-government protests against President Ali Abdullah Saleh, a U.S. ally against Al-Qaeda. In Syria, conservative Sunni Muslims, more antagonistic toward Israel than President Bashar Assad, could fill the vacuum if his government is toppled. The Muslim Brotherhood's calls for a relatively mainstream Islamic government appeals to the majority of educated and professional members. In Egypt's first taste of true democracy, the Brotherhood and more fundamentalist Salafist organizations, however, told followers that it was their religious duty to approve a referendum on constitutional amendments that benefited Islamists by speeding up elections. One of Egypt's leading ultra-conservative sheikhs, Mohammed Hussein Yaqub, influenced by Saudi Arabia's Wahhabi strain of Islam, was quoted as saying after the referendum had passed, quote, "That's it. Egypt, the country, is ours," unquote. Such sentiment shows that in a span of weeks, age-old religion, not the enthusiasm and slogans of the Facebook generation, is likely to be a crucial factor in choosing a new Egyptian government. This swift change has surprised even the Brotherhood, which avoided references to Islam during an uprising that was not inspired initially by religion. Emerging secularist parties may yet find support from those fearful that bearded men and the Islamic tenets of radical elements within the Brotherhood are hijacking their revolution. The military council's decision to hold parliamentary elections in September instead of May will give non-religious parties more time to win voters. But liberals and secularists have not regained the momentum they enjoyed in the early days of the revolt, even as extremist gangs recently attacked a cafe that sells alcohol and cut off the ear of a man accused of renting a flat to, quote, indecent women, unquote. And skipping down, speaking of the aforementioned Mr. Ibrahim of Gamaa al-Islamiyah, Ibrahim was a young medical student specializing in dermatology when he embraced Gamaa al-Islamiyah. The group called for an Islamic caliphate and condemned Mubarak, whom it tried to assassinate as an infidel. Ibrahim said 50,000 of its members were arrested, including at least 100 who were executed during Mubarak's reign. Sadat's assassination at the hands of radical Islamists, including Ibrahim and other members of Gamaa al-Islamiyah, had hardened the nation against religious conspirators. Mubarak took power and immediately imposed a state of emergency, essentially a war against Islamists and other political enemies that has lasted until today. And it remains to be seen what exactly happens. We're going to talk more about, we're going to prognosticate more about the future. Suffice it to say that this article points out that it appears that the army and the Mubarak forces may very well have allied with the Muslim Brotherhood in sort of a conservative coalition to prevent any real reform. But more about this article in Side 2 of the program, because this concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program number 739, Turkish Taffy, Part 3. My name's Dave Emery. This program has been recorded on April 10th of the year 2011. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.